Welcome back to the program. We know from the events in Wisconsin and neighboring states that public sector unions have become political whipping posts of Republican politicians, especially governors. But where Wisconsin's Governor Walker may have overreached and seems to have proven politically tone-deaf, and Arnold Schwarzenegger was timid here in California, New Jersey's Governor Chris Christie may have found the sweet spot as the pitch-perfect spokesman to an electorate fed up with rising salaries and perks for public employees and their unions. In so doing, he may actually have a chance to move his state forward, reducing deficits while engaging in endless bloody battles, and at the same time becoming more popular in the process. Is he the model for other politicians, or just a big bully who knows how to craft a message? All of this is part of the cover story in this past Sunday's New York Times Magazine by a man who I consider to be one of the very best political reporters in America. He is Matt Bai, recently returned from other pages in the New York Times to be the chief political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. It is always my pleasure to welcome Matt Bai to this program today to talk about his cover story about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, the disruptor. Matt Bai, thanks so much for joining us.
Of course, Jeff. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. When one looks at the way Chris Christie came to office, a pretty lackluster campaign and winning primarily because John Corzine was so unpopular, there was no hint, as you talk about, that this guy was going to be so effective as a YouTube star on the one hand and really being so effective in crafting a message against this issue of the abuse of public employees.
You know, I've criticized Christie's 2009 campaign so much now, and I wrote about it back in 2009, that I got a note from somebody who worked on it last week saying, "Will you stop calling our campaign uninspired?" but it was. I mean, it was really it was a lousy campaign in my view. It was. I was there writing about it at great length, and it was. You know, he had very little to put forward by way of ideas. They were very cautious. They wanted to make it a referendum on the incumbent governor, John Corzine. They really didn't ask for much by way of a mandate from the voters, and they offered nothing by way of specifics. So when Christie comes to office at the end of 2009 and in the transition and then takes the oath in 2010, he really has no idea what he's going to do or what he's up against. And the way he tells it is, you know, they came to him early on in the transition and said, look, Goldman Sachs did an analysis, and the state's going to run out of money next month. And this got his attention, and they sat down and looked it over, and he said, you know, they all came to the conclusion that you really weren't going to solve this problem short-term and long-term until you dealt with the pensions and benefits. Now, you know, people hear that story and will say, well, yeah, Chris Christie's a Republican and a conservative, and he had no great love for unions. He had a terrible relationship with them during the campaign, and I'm sure his attention gravitated very quickly toward hurting the unions. But and there's probably some truth to that. He's certainly more open to that argument than a Democrat would be. But I think when you talk to budget experts in New Jersey, when you delve into the picture, when you look at the money, unlike Wisconsin, as you said in your opening, and some other states, New Jersey is a state where it's very hard to make the argument that you could simply raise taxes and get out of this. It's very hard to make the argument that you can simply cut state spending and get out of this. There is a structural problem in New Jersey, as there is in other states, related to public worker benefits and also related to the contracts that drive up costs in the localities. And so I think part of the reason that Governor Christie has more traction than some of these other governors is that he has a very strong case to make.
As you point out, he's talking about $100 billion in unfunded liabilities in New Jersey.
Yeah, $100 billion. What that means, you know, we throw numbers around like this, and I think it's hard for people. Part of the reason this issue never gets addressed and hasn't for decades right. In all these states is because it's so hard to understand. I mean, it's hard for me to understand. It's hard for people who cover this to understand. And I can tell you, I'm talking to 10 people about it in New Jersey in any given week, you know, you'll get 10 different interpretations. But the deal is, when we talk about that $100 billion, that means that right now, today, if you wanted to fund the pension system and the health care system in New Jersey for retirees so that it was sound for the next 30 years, you would need to come up with $100 billion. Now, obviously, today you don't need to be, you have the question answered for 25 or 30 years out, so that's a bit of a theoretical figure. But what it tells you is you're not, you know, these pensions and health care benefits that the unions are fighting for, they're in jeopardy. If this doesn't get fixed, people aren't going to get their benefits. And this is not just New Jersey. This is in a lot of states all over the country. It's in principle the same argument we have about Social Security on a federal level. And you know, this is a very real danger in New Jersey. It's a huge amount of money. You got to figure the state budget is $30 billion a year. So you're not going, I mean, the point really here is, you know, when you hear from a lot of people, and I heard from a lot of readers who said, well, why aren't the wealthy paying their fair share? Raise taxes, because Christie did refuse to renew a millionaire's tax. And that is an issue of fairness to people, and I think a very legitimate issue of fairness. But you also have to remember that that tax would have raised less than $1 billion a year. So as a budget expert who's been on both, who's worked for both parties, very credible, does some work at Princeton, a guy named Richard Keefe, he said to me, you can't tax your way out of this. And I think that the numbers, you know, would hold that up.
Given the complexity of this issue, given how hard it is to talk about and really how difficult it is sometimes to make people understand these issues, how did this movement against public employee unions become so viral, using New Jersey and Christie as an example?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, Jeff, because it's hard to understand. It's far out on the horizon, right? So it really does, you know, make you wonder, you know, how does an issue like this get traction? A large part of the answer is a recession, and the fact that, you know, people are both looking for answers in the budgets, because all the gimmicks are gone, right? The governors have used all the gimmicks. There's nowhere else to go. They've already built their casinos and issued their bonds and used their tobacco money. And so now closing shortfalls is really requires the tough stuff. And it's also because private sector unions, right, the workforce in the private sector, and union and non-union, has gotten so beat up over the last decade, have lost so many of their defined benefits, have lost so many of their protections, that they're very receptive to this argument now in a way that they weren't, I think, 10 or 15 years ago. Because when you come to other workers and say, hey, these public sector guys, they're not paying a dime for their health care. You know, your teachers, who you love, and we get that you love your teachers, but they're not paying a dime for their health care. They're guaranteed state health care benefits for life. They're paying a tiny fraction of their pension contributions, less than other unions are, your cops and your firefighters, and we've got this huge budget shortfall. I think now you get a much more receptive audience if you're Chris Christie, because people have lost so much of their security in the workplace it seems to them an obvious issue of fairness that the public employees who are getting taxpayer money should have all those protections kept. Now, you know, the argument that the unions make, and I think it's a fair argument, it bears repeating here, is, look, just because private sector workers lost all this doesn't mean we should, right? I mean, we're not in a race to the bottom here. Maybe we should be thinking about how to improve the lot of private sector workers, not how to bring public sector workers down to the same level of insecurity. And I think that's a very fair argument, but the essential dynamic nonetheless makes it much easier for politicians to make this argument than it used to be.
Christie is engaged in this kind of death battle now against the unions, even to the point of this death wish incident that you talk about. To what extent did Christie come to this with any kind of personal animus towards public sector unions?
Well, I think he's got a personal animus. I mean, he would say otherwise, probably, but I don't think that's right. First of all, he's a very conservative politician. He thinks unions are too strong. They had a very rocky relationship during the campaign. He refused to come and ask for the endorsement, refused to come and meet with the teachers' union. He clearly doesn't like them. So that he says he loves teachers, but he hates the union. So that clearly was a factor in this. And he's a combative guy. Look, he likes to have fights. I mean, again, he'll tell you, you know, look, I don't love to fight, and I'll stop fighting when I run out of fights to have, is the quote he uses, and it's a quote we put in the headline. But, you know, the truth is that, you know, this is a comfortable place for him. He likes to have the argument. He's a direct guy. He doesn't mind the conflict. And so, you know, it is, to some measure, what's happening in New Jersey is reflective of both his personal style and his personal philosophy.
And as Corzine said of him in the campaign, he likes to throw his weight around.
Yeah, that's an ad they probably wish they could take back. I mean, there is, you know, Christie's a fascinating guy, well, for a lot of reasons, but in part because his stature, right? Look, the guy's fat, and you know, I got a couple emails after the piece came out saying you called him fat, and that's, you know, a terrible thing or what have you. I mean, look, the guy's fat. He'll tell you he's fat. I mean, we're here to tell the truth. He's a large man. And because of that, I think people underestimate him. They look and they say, there's something intuitive that people think. They say he must be undisciplined. They see him as a bully. They see him as a slob, right? There's a whole set of assumptions that go with his weight that Corzine tried to exploit in that campaign. And they're really wrong about Christie. Whatever his deal is with his weight, and that's, you know, between him and his family and whatever else, You know, the fact is he is a very methodical, strategic, and sophisticated politician. I would say, you know, I'm all over the country, and of course right. I watch the White House very carefully and talk to them. I think Christie probably has the most sophisticated strategic messaging operation in the country right now in terms of figuring out how to frame his argument and how to go out and make it to the public in a very sustained way. It's something the White House really could have stood to learn, frankly, in those first couple of years in office. And so I think a lot of the assumptions people make about Chris Christie are wrong and work to his advantage.
Talk about the way he has framed these issues, the way he has used metaphor to make the people understand what we've already talked about is kind of a complex set of issues. And in many ways, my sense of it at least, is that his training as a prosecutor was really his most valuable asset.
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, it's interesting. You would look at Chris Christie and you would think, here's a guy who hasn't been in politics, really. He had a small, you know, a local role in a town, but you know, here's a guy who's never made public policy, never legislated anything. You know, how could he possibly be the guy prepared or the guy you would want to be dealing with an $11 billion shortfall? And I think as you point out, there's another way to look at it, which is he has been a prosecutor, right? He was not a prosecutor, you know, he was a title or a state lawyer early in his career, but he did serve as a federal prosecutor, as the U.S. attorney for many years. He got very good reviews in that job, and he knows how to make a case. He knows how to talk to a jury. He's really good at it, and that's why he does these town halls. He's done 30 or so. It's something a lot of governors could not do as effectively. So his skills in terms of communicating and making an argument and belittling, frankly, his opponents, and boiling down the arguments to such a level of simplicity that whether or not they're entirely accurate, they seem awfully simple and self-evident, that is a skill that is serving him extraordinarily well at this moment.
Talk about this metaphor of the toolkit that has really become the central component of the way he pitches his goals.
Well, you know, the toolkit, I use it as an example. Because, you know, the toolkit's a pretty well-used image, I think, in public relations, but not in politics. And again, it's this gap where, you know, politicians haven't always thought about how to frame their ideas in with the kind of imagery that make them very sellable. And, what Christie is doing in part is he's capping property taxes. He's forcing municipalities to lower their costs, and it can seem very draconian. I mean, I'm trying to think of the number they've laid off. I think thousands of teachers were laid off around the state, and I think that's right. I wouldn't want to be quoted, but it's somewhere. It's either in the high hundreds or in the thousands. And so what Christie unveiled is these 33 laws, which are very arcane, many of which would be very hard to understand, but he unifies them in the notion of the toolkit, and he says, look, these are the tools, the sort of menu items, that we want to give municipalities that will enable them to lower their costs. And that ranges in everything from a law that says if you're a local worker, a public worker, and you retire, you can't get more than $15,000 of your vacation and sick time as a payout when you leave. Because Christie says, call me crazy, but I think sick days are for when you're sick, right? There's also something as arcane as kind of what they call interest arbitration reform, which I won't get into, but it's a really big deal in New Jersey because it's about the ability of unions to appeal their contracts to a independent authority, which often gives them higher raises than they've negotiated. So in this respect, you know, the toolkit is Christie's way of telling voters that he's empowering local communities rather than restricting them. And I think in that sense, it's a very smart way to put together an agenda that would otherwise be very confusing and very complex and might seem actually very draconian.
And he's very good at projecting this, you know, they're getting something for nothing metaphor, as you point out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he tells this story when he talks about this in his town halls. He has all these riffs, these standard riffs. And one of them is about the health care options you get as a state worker. And there are three options, and they range from poor to good to really good. And they all cost the exact same percentage of your salary, 1.5%. And he says, well, then everybody takes the really good plan, don't they? And in his telling, the woman who's come from the benefits office says to him, well, 96% of our employees take the really good plan. And he says, my reaction to that is bring me the other 4% because I want to know what they're thinking. And when I start laying off workers, they're going to be first. Because when you give people something for nothing, they're going to take it. And his argument, of course, is that for a better plan, you ought to pay more. And you know, it's a laugh line and it's funny, but it really, you know, I think it turns rooms, which is something you don't often see in politics, Jeff. I mean, I think, you know, I saw him in one town hall where I felt that he had a fairly, not a hostile audience, but a very skeptical audience early on, and had most of those people turned by the time he left because of stories like that and people nodding their heads and looking and thinking, well, that's pretty obvious. And it drives Christie's opponents insane because oftentimes he is boiling it down to a level of simplicity that ignores other arguments and other factors. And he is the governor. He does have, you know, he can hold these town hall meetings. He can pack the rooms. And so, you know, it is hard to counter him. But, you know, no one should mistake the unions in New Jersey for being powerless. I mean, the teachers' union has $100 million. They spend a lot of it on political organizing and advocacy and advertising, and they've come at him very, very hard. And at the moment, they're losing.
Right. I mean, as hard as they've come at him, he, as you point out, he has them kind of backed against the wall at the moment.
He does. He does. And that's for a bunch of reasons. I mean, partly it's the recession and where the budget is at and all the things, you know, you and I have just talked about, the notion that workers are receptive, private sector workers are somewhat receptive to this argument in a way they didn't used to be. But frankly, it's also because the unions are at a date on this issue. You know, for many, many years, the teachers union, I keep going back to the teachers because they are the major powerful union in New Jersey and the one that Governor Christie's gone after. For many, many years, the New Jersey teachers union was unparalleled in its power. It's a very powerful, very wealthy union. Teachers are beloved in New Jersey. They have an excellent school system. And the teachers were a very powerful political force that you would not want to cross if you wanted to run for legislature or local offices in New Jersey. And I think the climate has changed as a result of all the things we're talking about. And Governor Christie is very, very talented at exploiting that climate. And the unions have not caught up. You know, they still think that if they dig in, refuse to give and try to outlast this guy, he will come and go like everyone else, and the old system will prevail. And right now, they may be right. I'm not saying that that can't happen. Certainly, Christie could wear out his welcome. An improved economy would certainly make it harder for him to make this case. But I think right now they're losing because people just fundamentally feel differently about these issues and more anxious about these issues than they did 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And I don't think – and also they have a dimmer view of teachers' unions in general because of all the talk around education reform and tenure and merit pay. And I don't think the union has caught up to the reality that they're actually facing.
And, of course, the overriding question then, as you pose at the end of this story, is whether he can convert all of this into a larger kind of revised social contract for public employees.
Yeah, it is because, you know, at the end of the day – that is what he's really trying to do, right? Through the toolkit, the 33 laws, through changes to the pension system, changes to the healthcare system, he's trying to establish a new normal for what teachers and other public workers, and the cops and firefighters, by the way, who often get left out of this conversation, but, you know, very few governors are willing to go after police and firefighter unions, and Governor Christie has in terms of the retirement benefits. And, you know, he's trying to create a new, he calls it a new normal, and I think that's a good way to describe it, an entirely different standard of what's fair to expect when you go into public service. And I think, you know, whether he can do that depends in large part on whether people get sick of the conflict, whether he can be outlasted by the unions, or whether, in fact, the case is compelling enough that he can actually get this stuff through the legislature this year, particularly the changes to the pension system. And I think there's something else at stake, Jeff, which is, and I think Democrats should be looking at this very carefully, which is the question of, can you do this without denigrating public servants? Because I don't think Governor Christie's really done that. In the end, even if he wins, he's going to have done it by tearing down teachers, even if that's not his intention, and he says it's not. He's going to have done it by making public sector unions look greedy. And I think, you know, for people who are supporters of the union movement, and that includes most Democrats in these positions of power, the question is, how do you deal with these really substantive budget issues? How do you get to a new normal, as Governor Christie calls it, without making less noble and less appreciated the efforts of people who've devoted their lives and careers to public service, because they should be appreciated? And I think that's a really big question that everyone from the president on down ought to be asking themselves.
And finally, to the extent that Christie may succeed in all or part of this, what is his political future?
Well, you know, that's the zillion-dollar question. You cannot stop the Christie for president discussion going on in the Republican Party, which is as much a reflection of their dissatisfaction with the current field as it is with their notion of what kind of candidate Christie could be. I don't think on paper anybody would think of Chris Christie as your ideal presidential candidate. He doesn't look like your ideal presidential candidate, that's for sure. And he has an awfully sort of blunt, coarse style about him. But, you know, there's always these, especially in fields that are very unsettled, there's always the phantom candidate, the Wes Clark or the Fred Thompson or somebody that everyone hopes would get in. Christie has said just flatly he's not running. I absolutely believe him. I think he's too smart, frankly, to get engaged in that. He knows he's got his hands full in New Jersey. He knows he's too new at this. He knows the moment isn't right. I think he senses that it would not be politically wise, even if he wanted to be president, to jump in right now. And I guess you could foresee a draft or something like that. But those things never really happen. I think, you know, you have to look at Governor Christie and say, look, if he gets this pension and health care stuff done, if he is successful doing this in the next couple of years, then he is going to certainly be talked about as a 2016 candidate if President Obama gets a second term. But I'll tell you something, the annals of politicians who take on fights like this, who don't pass the buck, who actually try to remake a budget at the expense of powerful interests in their state and go on to fame and glory is not a long list. You know, that's a tough road to national prominence, and I for one would not count on it leading to national office.
Matt Bai, he's the chief political correspondent to the New York Times Magazine. His story, The Disruptor, about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, is the cover story in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Matt, always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Great to talk to you. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.